We're right up your street. This is Cambridge 105.
It's 12 o'clock on Saturday the 9th of February and you are listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105 with me, Matt Bentman and Alan Alder. Sadly, Ruth is away in Amsterdam at the moment, so if you're listening, Ruth, we hope you're having a good time.
Yes, and perhaps enjoying an Indonesian rice staffel, or maybe two.
On today's programme, we have news from Araomi, the Sicilian cafe and deli that's opening soon on Bennett Street. We meet the brewer and chef from Cambridge's new brew house in King Street, and Caroline Biggs will be talking about Eat Cambridge, the food festival that's taking place early next month.
Local historian Becky Proctor is here to talk more about Cambridge's food history, and in doing so gives the surprising news that Pease Hill is not named after peas. We also have our wine critic, Tom Lewis, who gives a pretty persuasive talk on sherry.
And of course, we'll have a roundup of the local food news and a review of the food ideas in today's Quality Press.
We mentioned last time that there are a lot of new restaurants, pubs and cafes opening in Cambridge. There's a range of styles from the, to me, rather corporate-looking Argentinian steakhouse Cow on Bennett Street, which is nevertheless attracting good reviews for its food, to the more rustic Sicilian cafe-cum-deli that is opening opposite. Called Araomi, this looks as if it might prove to be a very welcome addition to the Cambridge food scene. I say might because it hasn't opened yet, but when I spoke with owner Francesco Genovese about it, it did sound very promising. Francesco, tell us a bit about Araomi and what it is.
Well, with Araomi, we are creating something quite unique in the Cambridge food scene. We simply are a truly independent, authentic Italian coffee shop with a Sicilian twist. My family has been running a very popular, successful coffee shop since 1957 in a beautiful Baroque town called Acireale in Sicily. And that's pretty much what we'll be doing. We'll bring all our traditions, all our recipes, to the very heart of Cambridge, really.
Right, well, that sounds fantastic.
Indeed.
And there is no competition for that. There's other Italian places, but not with a Sicilian twist, is there?
Indeed, yeah. As I say, we definitely want to... We wouldn't not open something that was already out there. You know, we will have a distinct element with our product.
Okay, so tell me something about Sicilian food that Araomi will be selling.
Well, how long do we have? One thing is we'll focus on pizza. Pizza, for example, and we'll do something different again. We do what's in Italy called pizza impala, which is freshly prepared on the site, where actually people will be able to see the oven, and we'll also be able to see the pizza chef making the pizza. But the size of the pizza is a bit longer, and normally you just cut and buy in slices. And the fantastic, other than the taste, it's very soft. The pizza dough is left to rest for over 2 days, so the softness and the taste is unbelievable.
Right, so it's not the traditional circular pizza that we're...
It is not.
Right, and are the toppings different in any way?
There will be obviously some classical toppings like pizza margherita, tomato and mozzarella, but we'll also do like Sicilian versions, obviously, like pizza la norma with kind of aubergines on top, and we'll do lots of variety, and we'll also follow as much as possible seasonality, so that we pick, you know, the best ingredients available in that season as well.
Good, right. One of the things we think about when we think about Italy, but it's also, I mean, very much is ice cream. Is there a Sicilian view on ice cream?
There is indeed. Yeah, we definitely going to focus on ice cream. We won't start immediately. We'll start producing our ice cream, homemade, once again, freshly prepared on the site. But we'll start that from April onwards, when
the weather's warming
indeed.
Up a bit.
But yeah. let me just say that our place in Sicily is very well known for ice cream. We've got people coming from all over the place, really, to come and try our ice cream. So we will do that. We prefer to call it gelato, because this is pretty much what we'll be doing, and I can wait for it, really.
So you're going to be using the recipe that you use in your
100,
cafe?
100%.
Yeah, 100%. Right, so that should be really the genuine article, shouldn't
indeed.
It? And patisserie?
You know, we wouldn't be Sicilians otherwise. there will be a big focus. Let me say that, you know, the main focus of the shop is on food. We really want people to live and breathe the Sicilian atmosphere when they get in, from, you know, the colors, the friendliness, the warmth, but the smells as well. So once again, everything will be freshly cooked with them following our recipes. There will be, as we were saying, a big focus on patisserie with, you know, the most popular and delicious, like cannoli, obviously cassata, once again very Sicilian, but also we go on more like classic roots, obviously profiterole, tiramisu, and most important, we'll focus on what we call the perfectly bite-sized pasticceria, which is like some small bits of patisserie, which are very tasty and really nice to look as well.
Yes, well, that does sound tremendous. And presumably there'll be coffee available.
There will be some obviously great coffee as well. We'll use the same brand we've been using in Sicily since 1957.
Right, so this is really going to be a bit of Sicily in Cambridge, isn't it?
Yeah, that's our plan. As yeah. I say, we're going to follow all our recipes, and what I can say, we are absolutely passionate about what we do. We're looking forward to it. I lived in Cambridge myself for the last 9 years, and all my colleagues, every time they went to Sicily, they always pushed me, you know, why don't you do this and why don't you do that? And you know what, we are finally doing it.
Oh, well, that's great. And when does Aromi open?
That's a very good question. We are almost there. The plan is to open between the first or second week of March. There are a few bits and pieces to finalise, but we're pretty much on track, as I say, with the time frame. And the best thing for you to do anyway is just maybe to like our Facebook page. If you search on Facebook for Aromi Cambridge and like our page, we'll normally send an update every couple of days with sneak peeks of the products we will be producing on the shop, or updates on you know, when we'll be opening as well.
Okay, what are the opening hours?
We'll be opening from 9 a.m. to 8 p.m. We have obviously other plans for having extended working hours, but to start with,
I mean, you're next door to the Cambridge Arts Theatre, aren't you?
We are indeed.
So would you be able to cater for people who are going to the theatre? Will you be able to provide them with something before they...
Absolutely.
Get to the
we love our location. It's in a beautiful spot in this obviously beautiful city, and we are just in between the Corn Exchange and the Art Theatre in number 1 Benner Street. And yeah, we'll do lots of things connected to the theatre, so the people maybe can catch, can get a bite and get something nice to drink before going to the theatre. And yeah, so that's a quite nice spot we have there.
Yeah. One of the things that strikes me when I come out of the theatre is that there aren't very many places to go to afterwards, and I think a lot of people go to the Eagle pub. I know I tend to, and it gets packed.
Me too, yeah.
But you're talking about shutting at 8, so you wouldn't be catering for that.
Not to start with. As I said, we have lots of exciting plans once we open. So one of them would be to have extended working hours so that we can also cater for people when they leave the theatre. But you just need to wait a little bit longer for that.
Is Aromi purely a cafe, or can you buy foods to take home?
Yeah, you can indeed. Obviously, our main focus will be on food that you see on display cooked, and you can either eat in or take away. But we'll also have quite a few shelves around where with products on display, and all the products in there will be once again 100% authentic Sicilians, coming directly from local producers in Sicily, from you know, extra virgin olive oil to olives to lots of other extremely tasty things.
Right, well, that's interesting. You're saying they're produced what, on a sort of small scale? It's not great big stuff that you could get in the supermarket.
No, not at all. I say you can get the stuff everywhere, so we are not interested. We'll pretty much deal with local producers, so we're talking about no massive or multinational companies. We're talking about small firms that they produce and they are very passionate about their products, and we will bring that to our shop.
Right, so there's probably some really good quality
indeed
things on sale.
Yeah, we'll definitely the aim is to focus on quality and taste, so that's definitely our aim.
That sounds fantastic, Francesca. I can't wait for it to open.
Me too, to be honest. Yeah.
That was Francesco Genovese talking about Aromi, which is due to open in Bennett Street. And you like that?
I do. I'm very impressed.
That's due to open in the next 3 to 4 weeks. And a reminder that you can follow Aromi's progress by looking for its Facebook page, Aromi Cambridge.
And talking about social networking sites, you can keep bang up to date with Cambridge's food news by following Flavour on Twitter, at Flavour105. That's where you will read about the news we discover ourselves, and we also retweet food and drink stories from other Cambridge sources. Last week we broke several stories ahead of anyone else, so do follow us at Flavour105.
Coming up, Caroline Biggs will be talking about the food festival Eat Cambridge, and she'll be giving us some news about which events are about to sell out. Becky Proctor will be offering up some of Cambridge's food history. Tom Lewis will be talking about sherry, and of course we'll have our review of the best food and drink ideas in today's papers. Now, another new venture in town is the Cambridge Brew House in King Street. It's been opened by the company that owns the mill in Mill Lane, and it's made such a good job of doing it up. Now, the brew house occupies the building that used to be home to the bun shop. It's well named since it has its own microbrewery. Alan attended the opening last Wednesday to find out all about it.
I'm standing in the brew house of the Cambridge Brew House with James, who's the brewer. James, this is all staggering new equipment. It's not being used by the look of it. When's it going to start?
No, we're actually not brewing for another couple of weeks, but we've got the equipment in and it looks fantastic at the moment. It's all very shiny and very brand new.
It is a polished copper. It's really nice. And visible from inside the pub as well,
absolutely.
So it gives a really nice atmosphere. And what sort of beers are you going to be brewing?
We've got three we're brewing at the moment. So we've got a classic best bitter, which hopefully a good all-rounder that everyone can enjoy. Got a hoppy pale ale with a hint of wheat. And we've got a stout coming up, which should be available in the next few days. And then the first beer we're going to brew on the Cambridge plant is going to
be... Oh, I see. Those beers are from...
So they're from another small brewery that we have in Henley.
In Henley,
right. So they're being brewed specially for Cambridge, but as the Cambridge brewery isn't up and running yet, we're just bringing them up.
Yeah.
But we're hoping to be brewing not too long, and the first beer we're going to do is an American-style IPA, a really hoppy one for... That's what I've had a lot of requests for on Twitter and things. So.
And what sort of strength would that be?
That's going to be probably closer to 5%, so it'll be our more premium ale.
What's the capacity of the brewery? How long will it sort of keep you going for?
It's going to be, so it's 6 barrel in brewer's terms, which is probably about 1,000 litres or so per brew. So that's, getting on for 1,600, 1,700 pints per brew, and I can brew up to 3 times a week maximum, so that should keep us going quite well.
And once you've brewed it, you've got adequate storage, presumably?
That's right, yeah, we've got a nice room hidden upstairs for storing the beer in.
And are you going to be getting other beers in? Any other local beers, perhaps?
No, absolutely, that's the philosophy of the brew house, is not just have our own, but to have local beers as well. So we have 6 hand pumps on at the moment, 2 of which are beers that I've brewed, and 4 of which are very local beers. We have some from Lord Conrad's Brewery, Black Bar Brewery, so all within a sort of small radius. So
right.
That's a nice touch.
And is Joe from Black Bar still delivering by bike, do you know, or weren't you here to receive it?
No, I think he's coming in the van these days.
we're
thinking of getting a bike. So we have a sister pub in the mill in Cambridge, which we'll be supplying beer with, and I will be delivering every so often some beer on the back of a bike.
Right, so we'll look out for you. You'll become a local eccentric.
Yeah, just like Joe.
And what's your brewing history? You've brewed before. You've brewed in Henley, but have you brewed elsewhere?
Yeah, that's right. So I've been brewing in Henley for about 3 months. I'm the head brewer down there as well as in Cambridge.
Right.
But before that, I was the senior brewer down at Hotback Brewery in Wiltshire. where I was for about 3 years.
Yes, and they do that Summer Lightning
Absolutely.
Beer,
yeah,
don't they, which is, well, I think you can find it all over the country,
yes,
actually.
I think it's a really good seller, isn't it?
Yeah. Any sort of, I know it's early days, but have you got any plans for sort of special beers, to celebratory beers,
yeah,
beer evenings, anything like that?
No, absolutely. So both sorts of things. We're very lucky with small capacity. We can brew one-off beers for a certain event. So things I've done before are sort of a Burns Night beer with whiskey and honey, which went down really, really well. But also, yeah, we have the capacity to do events, so beer tastings, beer and food matching evenings, which I'm going to combine with Christian, our head chef at the brew house. We're going to do a sort of 5-course beer and food evening pretty soon, which should be great fun.
Yes, that sounds excellent, yeah. But when you brew a beer for the first time, I guess there's no way of doing it small scale. You've got to go, you know, whole hog, really.
Yes, yeah.
So how do you know it's going to work, or don't you?
There's a little bit of sticking your finger up in the air and hoping it works. But, you know, my idea is very much good ingredients means you're going to get a good beer out at the end. And whether it's exactly the beer you thought it was going to be at the beginning doesn't always matter, because it's always going to be something exciting to try and something new.
Yeah.
And those which are a hit with the drinkers here, we're going to brew again.
Yeah, I think you move through phases, don't you, of enjoying, I think, both food and beer, to sort of liking it, and then gradually becoming more experimental, and then gradually finding whether you find things interesting,
yeah,
or not is
right,
almost as important as whether you like them.
I agree, definitely. So that's, we're going to use our chance here to keep brewing new beers. So for every season we're going to have a new beer, we're going to keep introducing new beers and going back to old recipes and things, because
yeah,
we've got that capacity, which should be really good fun for me.
Yeah, and you're on Twitter, aren't you? So people, if they follow the Cambridge Brew House, will see...
That's right. So we have a Twitter account for the pub itself, and I have one just for the brewery, just for beery-related news.
Oh, right. So what's...
That's at Cambridge Brew Co., all one word, so... Yeah, please follow me on there.
So people need to follow that and find out what's brewing, so to speak. Yeah.
Yeah.
And this is your first lunch that you've been open.
That's right,
as
yeah,
well.
First day open to the public.
Are people drinking enough?
They certainly are, yeah. They're drinking quite a pace already, which is a good sign. A good sign, so hopefully we don't get hit too hard this evening.
Right. Well, good luck anyway.
Thank you.
Okay,
yes.
Thanks, James. Stop.
Well, I'm really looking forward to tasting some of the beers they brew.
What's it like in there? I haven't been in it since they reopened it as the Jolly Scholar, actually.
Well, downstairs it's been knocked through, so there is now just the one big room. It's been repainted and refurnished, and there's an attractive wooden floor too, so it has a good feel. One end has a nice pubby atmosphere, and there's even a table football and some board games. The other end is the eating area. There's a lot of plants both inside and outside, so it's looking good. It's a different style to the mill in Mill Lane, but then it's a very different sort of building. Upstairs is a boardroom which can be booked by a family or a group of friends for, say, a Sunday roast. You book the room, Chef Christian cooks the food and it's brought to your table, and you carve the joint and serve it all out, which I think's rather a nice idea.
Yeah, yeah. Did you talk with Christian about the food?
Yeah, I was pretty keen to find out about the food. Christian, what sort of foods are you doing at the brew house?
Well, we're planning on doing mainly, well, wholly British food, with an idea to do what we're calling British tapas, which are small plates rather than starters, ranging from £4 to about £5. And we've got things like shepherd's pie croquettes, scotch egg, sautéed wild mushrooms, and then we've got some braised pig cheeks as well, which is cooked really slowly, served in their own jus. So we're going for quirky kind of starters like that, stroke tapas.
And is the idea that, you know, like Spanish tapas, you would have several of them?
Yeah, that's the general idea. You could have two or three to share, four to share even, just as a starter.
That's a good idea, isn't it? Because often the starters are, you know, really quite imaginative, and you'd quite like to have two or three.
Yeah, exactly. It gives you the opportunity to share between your friends three or four, or yeah, you can sample a bit of everything. Or you can have the boards. We do some boards as well. They're also to share, which can be eaten as a starter, as a meal to yourself. We're doing a smoked and cured one, because we're smoking all our own stuff in-house.
Are you?
Yeah.
Right, what sort of things do you smoke then?
Well, we're smoking at the minute salmon, chicken, sausages. We'll maybe try the pig cheeks at a later date. Doing his own cheeses as well. So we do a mixture of that on a board to share with some bread and his own made chutneys as well.
Yeah. What sort of cheeses do you smoke?
Well, at the minute, to be honest, we're only smoking cheddar at the minute. The rest of us cheese we're buying from around the corner, the cheese place around the corner. So we'd just be smoking normal cheddar, but we may try some brie and some camembert in the future.
So there's going to be a few experiments going on to see what's
good. Yeah.
And how do you decide, you know, who's your testing panel? People who work
here? Yeah, people who work here, or me, chefs, people who work here. Everybody tries it.
But right now, yeah, I can see you've got smoked mackerel pâté.
Oh yeah, sorry, that's his own in-house smoked pâté, yeah, and then we make it into pâté sauce. Well, one I'm particularly proud of is the Douglas Adams. I'm a big Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy fan, and he's from Cambridge, so we decided to call it Douglas Adams.
Oh, I think that's right and proper. That's
right.
So what's the Douglas Adams one about then?
It's just a board, again, a sharing board. It's got the croquettes on it, scotch egg, some goujons, some sausages, chips, his own hand-cut chips, and some of his smoked garlic mayonnaise, which we're making in-house as well.
What times can people eat from until?
12 till 9:30 on Monday to Sunday.
Yeah, so you're keeping going right through the afternoon then?
Yeah, just to see where it lands, yeah.
Yeah. Any thoughts on allowing James, your brewer, to do some smoked beers?
Yes, yeah, that'd be great. Yeah, he's asked me to get involved with him, coming up with some beer recipes with him, which I'm very excited about because I've never done that before. So I can't wait to do that, yeah. We're using all his ales in the cooking as well. So we use him in his beer batter, for instance. We've got, fish and chips on. Just your ordinary fish and chips made with his own chips. And we're going to use James's in-house brewed beer to make the batter, which is good.
What sort of desserts have you got?
At the minute, we're doing a chocolate tart, chocolate and Cointreau orange tart. It's quite rich, dark chocolate. Winterberry eaten mess, which is just an eaten mess with raspberries and blueberries tossed through it and stuff. And then just a basic, nice, gooey, sticky toffee pudding.
The old favourites.
Yeah, yeah, with hot chocolate sauce. And a few ice creams, and then we're doing a cheese board, which we're getting the cheese from around the corner, from the Cambridge Cheese Company. And then we're putting a few of the smoked things on there as well. Generally having six different cheeses to choose from, you know, with some of the classic English ones and the smoked ones that we're doing in-house.
Mm. James said that, you know, you'll probably be having in the future some special evenings matching foods with beer.
Yeah.
So would that be a different menu, or will it be this menu with selected beers to go with?
I would imagine we could match some beers up to the food on the menu already. But then, I mean, I'm sure we'll be doing some ale nights with specific special dishes to go with it. Yeah, ale and pies springs to mind, but with a twist, maybe.
Good.
That was Christian from the Cambridge Brewhouse, newly opened on King Street. And early reports from Flavour's undercover agents enthused about the pig's cheeks and the Scotch eggs particularly.
And you're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city. Coming up, Caroline Biggs talks about the food festival Eat Cambridge and gives us some tips about which events are selling out quickly. Becky Proctor on Cambridge's food history, Tom Lewis on sherry, and our review of the best food and drink ideas in today's papers.
Yeah, and a reminder that you can keep up to date with Cambridge's food news by following Flavour on Twitter, at Flavour105. That's where you will read all about the news that we break ourselves, and we also retweet food and drink stories from other Cambridge sources. That's at Flavour105 for frequent updates of food and drink in Cambridge.
Let's take a break from the current food and drink scene and go back to the past. Here is local historian Becky Proctor talking about Cambridge before the days of Tesco, Sainsbury's, Waitrose and Acadu, which I still can't pronounce, and and how several streets in Cambridge are named after the foods that were sold in them. There's a bit of a surprise when it comes to Pease Hill, though.
Until really relatively recently, Cambridge was a very small market town, and the market was the centre of everything, as much in 1950 as it had been in 1201, when it sort of was given its first charter. I believe we just celebrated our 800th anniversary, didn't we, not that long ago. And so it really is the centre of town. And interestingly, of course, all the streets that run off of it are then also connected with the market. And at one time in medieval times, then certain streets and certain parts of the market would sell a particular thing. So if you've been to York, you'll have probably walked along the Shambles. Now, the Shambles is an old word for like a butcher's row. And Cambridge had its own butcher's row. Petit Curie, they think, stands for Little Cook's Row. Market Street used to be called Cordwainer Row. Shoemaker's Row. So you see that actually the centre of town was all about trade, and of course most of that was food.
And Pease Hill?
Pease Hill is one of my favourite fascinating facts about Cambridge. It's the old fish market, and there's some really lovely old photographs that you can see showing the old stalls there and the old fish stalls.
But why peas in that case? In fact, why Hill?
Well, we'll deal with the peas bit first. The Latin for fish market is piscaria, something called pesca, you know, the fish.
See,
so it's probably just a very bad Cambridge pronunciation, and Peas Hill. And probably, you know, hundreds of years ago, it would have been a bit more obvious that they were hills. All that area is very important for the history of food, the old markets. And, you know, some of your listeners may remember that Petty Curie had a Dewhurst Butcher's, a Lyons tea shop, coffee shop, and the old McFisheries fish shop was known because it had a sort of a big fish tank in the window. And
When did that disappear then? Any idea?
Really, I mean, obviously 1970, around that time, that was when all of, you know, half of Petty Curie was pulled down and the Red Lion, went. So that's the big change. But certainly up until 1970, a lot of people are going to be doing their shopping right in the centre of town, as people had done for hundreds of years, and that all changed. And of course, then there were the annual markets that you had in Cambridge, and Sturbridge Fair, which is where Sturbridge Common is, if you've been to the Museum of Technology, and the big Tesco's, that area. I suppose it's quite ironic that the big Tesco's is there, isn't it? That would have been an absolute massive fair in September every year. And it was one of the biggest fairs in England, possibly even one of the biggest fairs in Europe. Very, very well known. And there's this wonderful description of it in Daniel Defoe's tour through the whole island of Great Britain. And that's about 1720s he visited Cambridge. And I always say, he talks about Cambridge in about a paragraph or two. He talks about three pages worth about the Sturbridge Fair. He was really impressed by it. And the only clues we have to this amazing big fair are the street names that are left. So we've got Oyster Row, Cheddar's Lane and Garlic Row. And they are the sort of the last visible signs of this once great fair.
Well, what sort of fair was it then? A fun
everything.
Fair?
Well, that's the interesting thing. Of course, fairs in the past, it's all about trade, and that, so you could buy anything, but so many people would have come to the area for the fair that naturally entertainment grew up, and they had sort of tents with sort of temporary sort of food stalls there, so you'd have been able to live there, you know, feed there. Yeah. The whole town would have been absolutely full of people. And so as time went on and the trade diminishes because of various reasons like the canals and the railways, all that's left is the fun fair part. So Midsummer Fair, which we still have in Cambridge, that's all that's left, the fun fair. But you will probably remember, if you have been there, that there used to be a lot of china stalls. You'd get people selling china off very cheap. And that's a tradition that stretches back hundreds of years. And it was known as Pot Fair.
There are still now some little local bakeries in Cambridge. The Norfolk Street Bakery, which has just reopened, owned by a Portuguese woman, and there's the Newnham Bakery, and there's Dorrington's in Arbury, isn't
there?
That's
right, yeah.
But presumably there must have been, in every little area, there must have been
several. There would have been several bakeries. And I guess, as you know, we know that that's what really England and Britain as a whole has lost. We don't go and shop locally, but of course so many sort of people work, you know, 9 to 5. It's very difficult to go shopping. You know, that depends on a very different kind of family and living structure. Usually, you know, women having the time to go shopping, or if you have money that you can afford a servant, the servant goes shopping. And, of course, lots of tradesmen had boys who would then deliver in the same way that Arkwright's shop in Open All Hours. He had is it Granville, used to go around on the bike. You know, but this is at a time when labour was cheaper. So you can have all these small local shops providing your food. Mm. Now that's sort of impossible. I suppose the only similar thing is you've got the online shopping, you know, where it's dropped at your door. So I certainly think, yes, that there is something that we've lost, and it's always such a joy, isn't it, when you go to France on holiday and you see that they still buy their bread from a small bakery and it tastes so good.
Yes, it is.
But, things started changing a long time ago, and we probably can't go back. It's just great that people are starting up small bakeries and trying to, Yeah, bring something back, because of course, you know, all these terms, you know, locally sourced, organic, in the past it wasn't necessary because all food...
all food was local.
Pretty much locally
Although
sourced.
Some of the fish, I mean, you talked about the fish at Pease Hill and the Mac Fisheries in Petticoorie. I mean, that would have come from the coast, obviously, from the sea. There would be some river fish as well. So there was some... importation.
Of course,
from,
yes. And in the past, because they couldn't guarantee the freshness of food, then lots of people, certainly throughout the winter months, so, you know, January, a good example, they would have been eating pickles, they would have been eating salted meat and salted fish. So good old herring, which I like,
would have been
a staple.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, we forget that people didn't have fresh food throughout the year. They would have been eating an awful lot.
Yeah.
I think probably, you know, the basis of British culture is probably pickles. I think more people should eat pickles.
What's the story about milk from a bull?
Milk from a bull. Well, you can still see it. You go down Hills Road and there's a beautifully repainted sign on the side of one of the shops and it says Bull's Dairy. And their little sort of slogan they had at the time was the only place you can get milk from a bull. So some of these old shops had these wonderful sort of painted adverts on the side of the... Some of them have been repainted recently. I know that there's a pub in Histon, the Red Lion, that's had one repainted. And
you're listening to Flavour, and that's our part one of our interview with local historian Becky Proctor. That was an advert for Underdog, believe it or not. So now back to part two of Alan's interview with local historian Becky Proctor.
There was a very famous grocer's store which was in Trinity Street. I think I've got the right shop. I think it was where Heffer's or Blackwell's bookshop is now. And Matthews and Sons Grocers was apparently an absolute delight. One of those places you walked in and you got that smell of coffee. You would go to one counter and they would slice you ham, and then you got your butter from another counter, in the same way that the old Sainsbury's, which was on sort of the join of St Andrew Street and Sydney Street, sort of very close to where Waterstones is, the shop would have been. That was a similar kind of shop, so full of wonderful smells. You had to queue up at each different counter. Again, linking to the fact that we don't have time to do that anymore and have our food sort of properly wrapped and exact amount sort of weighed out for us.
So when did that go, approximately?
Well, certainly in the Matthews and Sons grocer shop, I think would probably it was there until the 60s, but I may have got that wrong. But there's,
yeah, I think a few of them went in the 60s, yeah. Actually.
Yes, Cambridge really experienced the same kind of changes in the 60s and 70s as most sort of market towns and big cities did around the country. I don't think it was unusual in that. Perhaps in Cambridge it lasted a little bit longer because we've got the presence of the colleges and perhaps a slightly slower pace of life for slightly longer. But yeah, Matthews and Sons is very well known. And I think a descendant of the Matthews family has written a very interesting book about her ancestor's shop. And certainly something which I remember when I was still a teenager in Rose Crescent. You may remember the Cambridge Health Food Shop.
Uh-huh.
Very old-fashioned type of place. And they would weigh out certain amounts of what you wanted and had been in, I think, one family for an awful, awful long time.
Yeah. It's a pity to lose these.
Right. And all that expertise, because that's the other thing. These are people who would have known about what they were selling.
Well, I mean, a lot of people on the market stall really are experts in what they're selling. And a lot of the people who set up their own little businesses, you know, they're not employed by somebody else to do it. It is their business and they really are. So I don't think we've lost that entirely. It might not be as prevalent as it used to be, but there still is a lot of expertise about, I think, if you know where to look. And local brewers will tell you, you know, the details of what hops they've used and so on in their beers. So...
And, of course, beer is something that's very close to my heart because I always say beer's in my blood. On one side of my family, they were publicans, and there were several publicans in the family. The reason I exist, really, is because they came and ran the mill by the mill pond. They were originally from Suffolk, so that's when they came to Cambridge.
So when would that have been?
I think they came here around 1918, something like that. I haven't been able to find out exactly. But that's on my father's side. And then on my mother's side, several of the family worked for the Bailey and Tebbets Brewery. Now all that's left of that is the old tap room, which is the Panton Arms. But there would have been in a massive, big sort of brewery round the back. And that was then taken over by Greene King in the 20s, along with all the other Bailey and Tebbets pubs. So, you know, they worked in beer for a long time.
Well, as we spoke previously about local bakeries, I mean, there must have been an awful lot of local pubs that no longer exist. I mean, one of the things about the part of Cambridge we're in now, in Gwydir Street, there still are quite a lot of local pubs, aren't there? I mean, Gwydir Street still has two. There's obviously Kingston Street has one, and a lot of the nearby streets have their own pub. But that must have been even more true in the past.
Absolutely. You really would have had sort of a pub on every corner. And partly because of the presence of the undergrads, who were always trying to get round the rules and regulations which govern their drinking and naughtiness. But also, you know, any area with lots of working people. So Romsey Town had lots of pubs, and this area around Gwydir Street, because there are lots of railway workers who lived here. And also, very important road, Newmarket Road, had lots and lots of pubs. In 1905, around that time, a lady was writing a study of Cambridge conditions of the labouring classes, and one of the things she was very worried about was the amount of pubs, so she counted a particular area. But she counted an area of Newmarket Road, and she said if you counted the pubs left and right on both sides of the street, she said there was a pub every 22 yards in a particular stretch. An interesting part of my family lived just alongside that, so I'm very proud. But there were lots of pubs. But Newmarket Road was the working heart of Cambridge. It had, you know, brickworks, it had the gasworks. You know, it's a very, very working area. And working was thirsty work. And if you think about it, over 100 years ago, you couldn't just go and get a bottle of Evian when you were a bit thirsty. You drank beer because it was safe to drink. And that's why lots of pubs are in working areas. And so, yes, undoubtedly, lots of working people spent too much money on beer, you know, out of very meagre wages that they earned. But, you know, you could probably imagine why they would want a pint in, you know, overcrowded houses, lots of children.
Yes.
And, they lived very simple lives and they worked hard. So a pint is always well deserved.
And what sort of hours would people work? How many hours a day?
I don't know. I mean, I couldn't answer that. It would depend on, you know, who you worked for, whether you worked for yourself. I certainly know that, for example, publicans worked long hours, and often you'll see when you look in the old sort of trade directories that publicans are often have another job. So they might be a publican and a coal merchant, or I've seen publican and clay pipe maker, or publican and cow dealer. You know, very interesting sort of combination of things. And of course, the whole family might get involved in working, in whether they were a publican or another trade. And that you can certainly imagine, you know, the publican's wife doing stints in the bar and the husband maybe doing something else. Lots of women worked and took in laundry in Cambridge because of the presence of the colleges and so many undergraduates and lots of washing to do. So you certainly can't say either that women didn't work in the past, because lots of women did, whether it be bedmakers, all kind of menial jobs.
Did pubs serve food as well?
They did serve food. And you will find records in sort of old diaries about Cambridge of, you know, people mentioning going to pubs and having meals there. So it would be sort of very, I would say, very British kind of stuff, very meaty, lots of sausages, veal chops, that kind of thing. So, of course, the Cambridge Chop House that you mentioned earlier, you know, is they're certainly trying to revive a tradition of eating, as I said, chops.
Well, also, I mean, there used to be meat and oyster pies, didn't there?
Indeed.
You know, a combination of beef and oysters.
Well,
for
oysters were the poor man's food. So, I mean, I mentioned Oyster Row when we were talking about Sturbridge Fair, because, one, the oysters were eaten at the opening ceremony, though. It was sort of that was part of the ceremony, so they ate enormous amounts of oysters. But generally, you would have seen oysters served on stalls at any kind of fair or market. It was the poor man's food.
Well, what a pity it isn't anymore. Great. Okay. Well, thanks very much, Becky.
Thank you.
If any of our listeners have any memories about Cambridge's food history, either their own memories or things that they've heard from parents or grandparents, or any old photos, Becky would be really interested. You can make contact with Becky via our email address. That's flavour@cambridge105.fm.
And you're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city. Coming up, Caroline Biggs talks about the food festival Eat Cambridge, Tom Lewis on sherry, and our review of the best food and drink ideas in today's newspapers.
And a reminder that you can keep up to date with Cambridge's food news by following Flavour on Twitter. That's at Flavour105. It was the first to tweet the details of the Hot Numbers Cafes Award from MP Julian Hubbard in the first of the Discover Cambridge Awards. We were the first to let you know about Andrew Northrup's homemade corned beef tastings last Saturday, and we've kept up with news of pubs, cafes and restaurants that are about to open. For example, the new burger restaurant Byron's in Bridge Street. So, you can keep up to date on Twitter by following us at Flavour105. We also provide a comprehensive retweeting service of local food and drink news.
In the last edition of Flavour, we spoke with Caroline Biggs about the forthcoming food festival Eat Cambridge, which has created an enormous amount of interest. Bookings have now started, and I spoke to Caroline yesterday to find out which events are filling up quickly so you can get in quick before they're sold out. Caroline, the programme for Eat Cambridge is published today, I think.
We are so delighted to actually finally be sharing the programme with everybody. It's been in the making for a long time, and so it's like giving birth almost.
Well, I'm sure it's not quite as painful.
Well,
but
I don't know.
And I know some bookings have started. So people can get in quickly should they need to, or are any sort of in danger of selling out quickly?
A big one that's going very fast, actually, is the Dine Like Downton, which Miss Soufflé is running at Hotel Divan with William Hanson. So if you want to know about etiquette for dining, that's the one to book up for. But as I said, there are very few tickets left, so do go for that one.
Right, and that's not the cheapest one on the list, I think.
I'm afraid it isn't, and people say that, but to be honest, actually, what you're getting for your money, it really is well worth it. It really is. I'm going, I must say, and I'm really looking forward to it.
Yes, well, it looks great. I've read the details. It looks superb.
And also, it'll be a great fun evening, as all our events will be.
Right. Any others that seem to be going fairly quickly?
Yes, Alan Brigham is doing an Eat Mill Road tour with Nibbles on the way. We're visiting 11 different food outlets, and that's going really fast as well.
And Alan Brigham knows so much about Cambridge, doesn't he?
He does, yeah. And he lives in the area, so he's quite passionate about supporting the independent traders in Nibbles.
Oh, that's excellent. So how many people are going to be able to go on that?
That is limited to 12 people, so that's why I recommend people to get in fast with that one as well.
Right, well, I might do that one myself. Okay, anything else you'd want to mention?
Well, on Sunday the 17th of March, we're rounding off the festival with an exciting food bloggers debate. We've got a panel of local food experts talking about food, and those people include Tim Haywood.
Well, he's always very entertaining, isn't
yes.
he? Right.
And Mark Poynton, who's the chef at Alimentum, will be on that panel, as will Tom Lewis, who you're very aware of.
Our very own.
And a few other people who are quite big in the Twitter and blogger world, like Ozzy. And we're hoping to get Daniel Clifford along, but he's not quite sure. He can't confirm it until last minute.
From Midsummer House.
Yes.
Yeah, that's brilliant. And where's that taking place?
That's really exciting. That's going to be at the McCrum Lecture Theatre. It's through the courtyard of the Eagle Pub. It's a Corpus Christi building. And the lecture theatre holds 120, but say bookings are going quite fast even for that number.
Yeah, well, it does sound
that's
good.
That's going to be a very special Cambridge event.
Yeah, right. These are what you're calling fringe events, aren't they? Because they're not taking place in the Guildhall on the...
On the 9th.
On the 9th.
Yes.
OK, any other fringe events you'd like to draw our attention to?
Well, there's a list of 30, which I won't bore people with on the radio. And so do go to our website to find out all the details. But we've just got some lovely things happening, like lovely Carrie Pavitt's going to have an event at 12A Club, a pie tasting. And the Clandestine Gourmet are doing a pop-up restaurant, which will be announced, the venue will be announced nearer the time. And also Hot Numbers are doing a coffee tasting. And there are tours of the Market Square with some Blue Badge guides. I'm looking to food outlets and the history of food on the market.
Oh, right. So some interesting things there.
There's
yes.
a whole range of things happening. We've got tea tasting happening at Duke House, B&B. Yes, so there's Gogmogog Farm Shop, who are one of our major sponsors. They're running lots of events at their premises. And they're doing a daily Scotch egg. So do go daily to try out their new Scotch egg. And a new company to Cambridge called Pie and Pints are going to be having a pop-up restaurant there.
So not only are there a sort of a lot of things, there is, as you say, quite a wide range of things, isn't there?
There's something for everybody. I mean, the street food market, which I think I mentioned before, which is on Friday the 15th of March, is Hope Street Yard, and that's going as free. So we've got buskers on board for that, as well as some street food vans and a cocktail bar. So there's something for everybody in this festival.
Oh, that's great. Do you think you'll do it again next year?
Once we've had a bit of a rest, I think.
That was Caroline Biggs from Eat Cambridge, and a reminder that you can find out about these marvellous events from their website. Simply type in Eat Cambridge 2013 into a search engine of your choice.
105 Drive with Julian Clover.
From Monday to Friday, 105 Drive takes you home with news, travel, entertainment, interviews, the quiz, that's my dog, and bits and pieces like this. You remember that Live Nation had some complaints previously from residents about noise levels at events it hosted in the park. Last July, fans at Hard Rock Calling were left bemused when Bruce Springsteen and Paul McCartney's microphones were switched off during a duet after a concert overran. Although having heard Paul McCartney sing live recently, I probably would have switched the microphones off as well.
Back Monday from 4 on your way home. Cambridge 105.
While the sales of table wines are growing very rapidly, the same cannot be said of sherry. It's unfashionable at the moment, and I must admit to drinking it at the rate of less than a bottle a year myself. However, Tom Lewis, our wine critic, has been asked by several listeners to give some information and a few recommendations, and we spoke about it earlier in the week, but this was in rather unusual circumstances, so it's recorded in mono. Do not adjust your ears. Tom, last time you mentioned that you'd had a request to talk about sherry.
Yes, Aoife Maxwell, who blogs as Gastronomic Girls, asked me to talk about sherry.
It does seem as though sherry is finally becoming more popular again, yeah?
The so-called sherry revival that was much talked about a few years ago. Along with Arndt and Vickers, it's one of those things that needs to be mentioned in any discussion about sherry.
But there was a list of the top 10 sherry bars in London recently, wasn't there?
Yes, it was in the drinks business. A few years ago, there wasn't even such a thing as a sherry bar, so to have a top 10 listing now is a sign of how popular sherry is becoming.
And what do you think has changed that? Why has sherry become more popular again?
It's a number of things. In part, I think sherry's reputation had got so low in this country that the only way was up. Secondly, I think there's been a focus on quality and style, away from those sweet and blended styles that we think of historically. Finally, I think sherry has just generally benefited from the gastronomic innovation that we now see in Spain. It's closed down now, of course, but El Bulli was for several years reckoned to be the best restaurant in the world. Spain is trendy.
So tell us more about sherry. What are the basics we need to know?
I think the key things to understand are how it's made and what the styles are. If we start with how it's made, the key elements are the grape variety. For the vast majority of sherries, this is Palomino. Next is the soil type. This is a spongy white chalk known as Albariza. This is important because chalk gives finesse. Finally, we have the Solera system. This is used for aging and blending. Sherry is aged in barrels, and a little, no more than a third, is bottled each year. The barrel is then topped up with younger wine, and so the blend is maintained. This means that in theory there is at least a little of every year's wine in the barrel from the initial fill onwards. This can be several years, decades, or even longer.
So all sherry is a blend, is it, and non-vintage?
Exactly. In that respect, it has many similarities with champagne. It's an elegant, non-vintage wine grown on chalky soils whose character comes largely from its production method. Like champagne, it's rather distinctive. It's instantly recognisable, but it's also quite versatile. The final thing about sherry is floor. This is a yeast that grows on top of the sherry in the barrel. It feeds on the new wine that's added and imparts a pungent, yeasty character to the wine. The first thing you notice about sherry is that it doesn't have a lot of fruit. The aromas are what we call evolved or tertiary. It's things like pungent yeastiness for the paler styles and roasted almonds for the darker ones.
I'm not sure how appealing that would sound to someone who's not yet tried sherry.
True, pale sherry has a distinctive tang that you probably either love or hate. Personally, I love it, but it's all about the finesse and the acidity. I think it's important to make the point that sherry is very much a food wine or an aperitif. It doesn't have any particular fruit characteristics to make it an easy sipper.
So what about the styles of sherry?
The basic style of sherry will be pale, either fino or manzanilla. A fino is fortified up to 15% alcohol and then aged in Solera with the growth of floor. A manzanilla is made in the same way as a fino, but comes from the region of Sanlúcar de Barrameda, where it's a little cooler, and so the floor grows thicker, giving a more pronounced, yeasty, tang sort of flavour. My go-to fino has to be Tio Pepe, which is very popular, very easily available, and very good. Two others to try are Hidalgo La Gitana from Cambridge Wine Merchants and Waitrose's Manzanilla Fino. Both Fino and Manzanilla should be pale, elegant and refreshing. They work well as an aperitif, especially on a hot day. Or they match with tapas-style food like jamón ibérico, manchego, olives and bread with oil.
Mmm, that does sound good.
And very easy to do at home too. A few slices of meat and cheese from the deli, some bread and a bottle of sherry popped in the fridge for an hour or so to chill. Lindsay Spellman at Cambridge Wine Merchant suggests that the rule of drinking perfectly chilled Fino is 1 at 11 or 11 at 1.
And what about the other styles?
Well, having mastered the paler sherries, we can now move on to the darker ones, which are more complex beasts. Amontillado is a Fino where the floor has been allowed to die away, so it starts to age oxidatively. That is, with some exposure to air. It gets darker and it picks up aromas of roasted walnuts and maybe some antique leather. An Oloroso is fortified up to 20% alcohol immediately, so that no floor grows at all. Again, it ages oxidatively, so it becomes darker and acquires those bitter roasted flavour characteristics. The final one to mention is Palo Cortado, which by right should not exist. It's a sherry that's destined to be a Fino, but where no floor grows, and so it ages oxidatively. It is either a freak occurrence or something special, depending on how you view these things. For the winemaker, though, it's very special, and it's considered the style by which you should judge a sherry house. It's very much the winemaker's baby. We can summarise these, then, as Amontillado was a Fino, Oloroso was never a Fino, and Palo Cortado should have been a Fino.
And what foods should we have with these?
The general rule is to have the white ones before dinner and the brown ones with dinner. These are all dark, so we need foods to match. Amontillado, in dry or medium forms, will match with roast beef, Yorkshire puds and roast parsnips. Try an Amontillado or an Oloroso with any sweet root vegetable soup, like spiced parsnip, or with butternut squash. I also find a beurre noisette matches well. This is basically melted butter, gently browned in a pan, with a drop of lemon juice added at the end. Sea bass with beurre noisette is a great match with Palo Cortado if there's a touch of sweetness in it.
Is there any particular temperature they should be served at, would you say?
The darker sherries I'd serve at something like pantry temperature, just a little cooler than room temperature.
And what about some recommendations?
I've got two Palo Cortados. Waitrose's own label Palo Cortado is very good indeed. It's made by Lustau and it has a bit of sweetness on the finish. Also, there's Gonzales Bias Leonor Palo Cortado from Cambridge Wine Merchants.
How much do all these cost?
Well, I wanted to show how good value sherry can be, so I've picked examples that generally cost around a tenner, often rather less. You will see greater complexity if you move up the price level, but these are all very good wines at this price.
And that was Tom Lewis talking about sherry, about which more in the next edition of Flavour in 2 weeks' time. And Ruth, if you're listening in Amsterdam, I hope you enjoyed Tom's comments about Spain.
Yes, I certainly did. I'm going to Madrid in a month and I'm looking forward to it even more now. Now, the information that Tom has just given about sherry, you can read all about it on his blog, which is Cambridge Wine Blogger. But now let's look at today's papers, which give ideas for the weekend's eating. In The Guardian, Hugh Fernley Whittingstall has some recipes for duck, while Fiona Beckett supplies the wine recommendations to go with them. Yotam Ottolenghi, who continues to romp across two pages, has recipes for a confit trout salad and for sprouting broccoli with anchovy. The new 16-page A4 cook supplement has the 10 best honey recipes, both sweet and savoury. Dan Leppard shows us how to bake what looks like a fantastic chocolate custard mousse cake, which eschews baking powder. There's a series of six photos to guide you through each stage of the process as well. Further on, Polish finger foods, how to avoid food waste, a speedy recipe for savoury bread, and Felicity Cloak tests readers' recipes, the pick of the crop being aubergine fritters. Finally, a page on combinations involving lemons, and a guide to mussels, and a recipe for mussel, potato and saffron stew.
Oh, and that's just The Guardian, right?
yes, it is incredible. On to the Financial Times, whose excellent magazine has just been nominated for a prize.
Jancis Robinson reports on Northern Rhones, one of my favourite wine regions. Rose Cararini has a recipe for chestnut, chocolate and orange cheesecake. I think that's quite an intriguing combination. Roly Lee's recipe today is for orange and frangipane pancakes, which are accompanied by an enticing photograph. Peter Balzalghetti gives a taste test to several brands of Earl Grey tea, and there are more pancakes in today's Independent magazine.
And I trust they're also accompanied by enticing photos?
Well, no, I'm afraid the print quality in the Independent remains a significant weakness. It's a pity because the hedgerow garlic and Asian mushroom brick sounds very good and deserves something better, really. There's also a recipe in the Independent for Scotch pancakes with Bramley apple and Crespelli with spinach and gorgonzola.
That's an incredible number of recipes. But are there any that you particularly want to focus on?
I think Dan Leopard's chocolate custard mousse cake looks very tempting, although I very rarely bake.
Yeah, I'm more of a baker than you are, I think, aren't I? I seem to enjoy that. But you were telling me just the other day about a cake that you'd baked.
Well, yes, I did, didn't I? That was a mandarin orange and almond syrup cake from Yotam Ottolenghi's Jerusalem book. It was incredible. Mm. His recipes are so over the top. But I think from today's papers, I'd probably try the aubergine fritters and the mussel potato and saffron stew. They're all in The Guardian. I'm not terribly keen on pancakes, so that rules out the recipes in the Independent and Roly Lee's in the Financial Times. His did look very good, though.
And what about Yotam Ottolenghi's recipes today?
The confit trout salad with golden beetroot and ricotta would be worth making, I think. It can be done ahead of time, too, so good if guests are coming to eat. You can get golden beetroot from time to time at Simon Steele's stall in the Sunday market, but the other ingredients, I think, are very readily obtained.
But is it important, though, to use golden beetroot, do you think?
Well, not really. I think it's for appearance's sake, mostly. Red beetroot wouldn't change the taste. The recipes from Hugh Fearnley Whitting's stall for duck look nice, too. Sadly, though, he writes in his introduction about how badly ducks are treated. Most farm ducks do not even have access to bathing water. I think it's dreadful.
Is there any way of attaining ducks that are better treated, though?
He recommends free-range or even better organic ducks, neither of which, sadly, are readily available in many supermarkets, he says. But there is, I don't know if you've seen it, Matt, but there is a stall on the Sunday market that sells duck, and I think I'll ask the stall holder about, you know, the conditions that they live in. I'll report back anyway.
Yeah, you said also there were Fiona Beckett has wine recommendations for duck. Not for ducks, but to drink with duck.
Yes, that would make them feel a bit better.
It would.
Yeah, she talks about specific recipes too, which is very helpful. For Yotam Ottolenghi's, for Hugh Fearnley Whittingstall's roast duck recipe, she suggests a right bank Bordeaux. And for his confit duck and beans, she suggests some wines from the southwest region of France or a southern Rhone. But Matt, being such a tea lover, I'm surprised you haven't asked me to say something about Peter Balzalghetti's testing of Earl Grey teas.
Alan, could you say something about Peter Balzalghetti's testing of Earl Grey teas, please?
Well, they tested 14 different brands.
Good.
It's a good article with some acerbic comments. One tea, and it's a very well-known brand, was said to carry a strange hint of the swimming pool. The panel distinguished between Earl Greys based on black China teas and those with Indian teas, the Chinese being blander.
And what sort of descriptive language did they use?
Yeah, that's always interesting. They were quite general sometimes. For example, strong, good flavour, or subtle. But one reviewer has the same gift of descriptive language as our own Tom Lewis does, describing a tea as having embracing spicy softness and mellow cigar box aroma. That could have been Tom, couldn't it? Finally, the panel discussed whether tea should be drunk with milk, lemon, or without either.
And what did they decide?
For the Earl Grey, the addition of skimmed milk softly moderated the tannins and the lemon just didn't work.
Good. And that reminds me that Sir Caroline Biggs earlier mentioned a coffee tasting session at Hot Numbers Cafe in Gwydir Street as part of the Eat Cambridge event, which sounds good fun.
Yeah, it does. But that's the papers today, Matt.
Good. Well, thanks very much, Alan. And that brings us again to the end of another show. Many thanks to all of our interviewees, Francesco Genovese of Aromi. I love saying that.
You're getting better.
James and Christian from the Cambridge Brewhouse on King Street, local historian Becky Proctor, Caroline Biggs from Eat Cambridge, of course, and finally Tom Lewis, our Cambridge wine blogger.
Do let us know your memories of Cambridge food and food customs. You can email us at flavour@cambridge105.fm. And don't forget to follow Flavour on Twitter at Flavour105 to keep up with the latest food and drink news. The next live edition will be on Saturday, February 23rd at 12 p.m. You can find our previous episodes on our podcast page on the Cambridge 105 website. Coming up next is Saturday Lunch with Davina and Scratch. At 2 o'clock, Sam Davis presents In Your Company. From 2.30 till 3, Roger Frost and Chris Creese are here with The Science Show. And from 3 till 5, Sean McKenna and the team bring you Saturday's Sports Zone. Do join us next time.
Goodbye.
Bye.